There's been lots of discoveries, but without a doubt, I think computing capacity, as we think about genetics and genetic improvement in dairy cattle, it's computing capacity that has really changed over the years. I mean, I think back to, you know, when I was in graduate school back in the mid-1980s, right? So there was this thing that came out called the animal model. So before that, all of the comparisons were only done on by, you know, sort of averaging out all of the production records of daughters of bulls, and the genetic evaluations were only calculated on those bulls because that's all that the computers could handle.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost gut health, performance, and profitability with Digestrum Prime, a phytogenic feed additive that enhances digestion and immune function in dairy calves. Learn more at dsm-firmenich.com/prime.
With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Adiseo USA, producers of SmartAmine M and MilkPay.com.
Lalamond Animal Nutrition, partnering in microbial solutions for a changing world.
Welcome, everybody, to this episode of the Dairy Podcast Show. I'm your host for today, Gail Carpenter with Iowa State University Extension. I'm joined today by Dr. Mike Schutz from the University of Minnesota. He is the head of the Department of Animal Science there. He began his current role as head of the Department of Animal Science on June 11th, 2018. Prior to his arrival in Minnesota, he was the Assistant Director of Extension for Ag and Natural Resources and the Dairy Extension Specialist at Purdue University in Indiana. He grew up on a small dairy and crop farm in Meeker County near Eden Valley, Minnesota. He got his bachelor's and master's degrees from the University of Minnesota, and his master's degree was in animal breeding. He earned his PhD in genetics and breeding at Iowa State University, and he went on to complete some postdoc work at the USDA in Beltsville, Maryland, where he developed a genetic evaluation system for somatic cell scores in dairy cows. After a brief stint in Canada as the chief geneticist for Canadian Beef Improvement, he joined the Faculty of Animal Science at Purdue University in 1996. He was promoted to associate professor in 2002 and full professor in 2010, and was designated emeritus at his departure. His other research accomplishments have included the work on the impact of heterogeneous variants on genetic evaluation of production records, development of the Grazing Merit Selection Index, pioneering work in dairy precision technologies, and practices to enhance dairy cattle well-being. His extension program has covered several areas from breeding and genetics to milk quality, milk marketing, and cow comfort. He's the co-founder of Indiana Dairy Producers and Indiana Milk Quality Professionals. His research interests continue around calf health and behavior and technologies to monitor the health of dairy cows and heifers. He has been a popular teacher of dairy herd management and developed the Dairy Farm Evaluation course at Purdue. He was recognized with the Steve Atkinson Indiana Dairy Leadership Award, the Charvel Award as Purdue's Outstanding Extension Specialist, and the University of Minnesota Block and Bridle Outstanding Faculty Award. Nationally, he has served as the president of the Dairy Practices Council and secretary of the American Dairy Science Association, and is the past genetics section editor of the Journal of Dairy Science. And he's here to talk to us today. So, Mike, you have spent a lot of time in extension. Can you say right now for the record that extension people are just more fun than research people?
Oh, absolutely, without a doubt. I mean, that just has to be the case, right?
Yep. So we get to go to, we're both part of the four-state dairy nutrition and management group. That's an extension group with Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois. And that's one of my favorite trips every year. We get together usually in May, all of the extension folks from the different universities, and they're just, extension people are just fun to be around.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really kind of unique that when that group gets together, you know, you kind of check the logos for the universities at the door, and everyone's there to solve problems in the dairy industry. And so I think that's what makes it really a lot of fun. Plus, everyone knows each other so well after working together for a while.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I feel like a lot of extension programs, in a lot of states around the country. We just don't have the same personnel that we used to 20 years ago. If we're all working together for the improvement of the dairy industry, we kind of understand that you got to help each other out, right? So I love being able to call up folks up at Wisconsin or Minnesota and say, hey, like I need somebody, like I need a professional or somebody with an expertise in reproduction to help me with this question. Like people are always really responsive and willing to help out. And yeah, I like how you say that. Like we all kind of rib each other sometimes. Like there's some good fun and good competition between the universities, but really we're all there to learn from each other. So,
well, oh, and we're also alumni of each other's universities anyway.
That's true. So. Yeah. I didn't realize you were an Iowa State alum until I read your bio, and didn't realize you lived in Canada until I read your bio.
Both very interesting experiences. Yeah. Great memories of the time I spent, as a PhD student at Iowa State in Ames. And
yes,
of course, what a unique opportunity to get, to go outside of the United States and work for a while and learn.
Yeah, I did that as I lived in Ontario for a couple of years. And it was really special. I love Canadians. They are great people. Mm-hmm. They are also really fun to be around. I got to live in this small Canadian town and learn how to curl.
Yeah.
I don't know if you had a chance to learn how to curl while you were up there, but
I did not, but it was it's always looked intriguing to me.
Yeah.
So the 2 years I spent in Canada, I spent 1 year at Ottawa.
Okay.
And then the second year in Calgary. And you know, what a contrast in the two cities. So you've got Ottawa, that's a very European looking, European style city. And you go out to Calgary and it's really just the Denver of the North. I mean,
yeah.
It's all about the big gas business and beef cattle.
It's the Wild West. Yep.
Yep.
And then you came to Indiana, which Indiana is also a great place. I do love people from Indiana as well. I know.
Indiana's great. And it just kind of calls to mind a little story. When I first got there, I was asked by a... I think I was just at a meeting and I was walking around. One of the extension educators from a Northwest Indiana county came and talked to me and said he wanted to introduce himself, but he didn't think they'd ever need a dairy extension specialist in their county because they had no dairy herds. And all of a sudden, you know, he's contacting me because Fair Oaks is going to be arriving in his county with, mm-hmm. you know, some 12,000 dairy cows. And he asked me to come and speak to his county extension board or his county board and also to his the Chamber of Commerce and in the local town. And it was just he thought it was a pretty ironic change of events for the county.
Not just a dairy farm, but the dairy farm in Indiana.
Absolutely. Just one that everyone knows about. But, you know, it's really the mark they had on the industry was amazing. And so I think, mm-hmm. you know, Indiana increased by about something like 50,000 cows during the time that I was there. So
I hope at some point in my career, I'll get to say that. We've been losing farms in Iowa. And that's true everywhere too, but at some point in my career, I'd love to be able to, yeah.
It's the case all around the Midwest, fewer, but still, sort of almost a growing percentage of milk production around the country. And so, you know, we're finding that having free water fall from the sky makes a big difference for dairy producers. And you know, there's a little bit of a return back to the Midwest and the Upper Great Lakes region.
It'll be interesting to see what the next few years bring, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Maximize profitability and herd health with early detection in animal health, reproduction, and feeding. The most advanced bolus technology and professional support from agricultural experts make this possible with SmaxTech, the health management system that future-proofs your dairy operation.
So you've had a couple administrative roles. You've done a lot of the extension stuff, but you were the associate director for, we call it ANR. I guess it's ANR at Purdue too, Ag and Natural Resources.
That was really an interesting role. certainly it reduced the amount of time I had to focus on the dairy industry.
Right.
But I learned a tremendous amount about how many of the other industries in Indiana were looking at kind of the same issues that were popping up in the dairy industry. You know, certainly the sustainability and environmental impacts with the arrival of larger dairy farms. Yeah, that was an interesting conversation that soybean and corn producers were very involved in, and you know, really, you know, seeing the role that they play in the industry and the value the dairy industry has as a consumer of their products. Mm-hmm. And so a fantastic opportunity to work through with some of those organizations, and you know, what an opportunity it was.
I've always said I would never want to be an administrator, but the administrators that I've met.
Said that too.
Yeah. I think a lot of people say that. I think the people that do say that, that's a red flag. Yeah. And I think the people that I've met in administration who have, or either working in extension or have an extension background, those are the people that make administration look like it's probably not the worst job in the world.
And I think that's true. And it's, you know, extension is so much about building relationships. And, you know, I think one of the mottos that my boss at Purdue I was had, and so did I, was that people have to know how much you care before they care how much you know. And I think that's driven more through extension than any of the other areas in the land-grant university. I mean, research and teaching are great, but there's just something special about extension, in my view.
Yeah, I agree with that. I've been doing more like trying to talk people into finding extension jobs lately. I have a couple, just had a conversation with a former student who's looking at different careers. And I said, you know, you'd really love extension.
Absolutely.
The people are great. And it's a joy to be able to help producers, right? And not have to worry about how your bottom line is impacted by it.
And I think, you know, one of the huge challenges that we had in extension, and like in any other, you know, sort of public service kind of job, is just that, you know, public funding to support those opportunities was not great. So the big challenge was just the turnover that we had in, particularly in local extension. And, you know, so I think in the 4 years I was in my role in extension, we had something like a 60% turnover rate. Oof. And so just because people have, you know, have other opportunities that, you know, they're well-trained, they're you know, really top-notch individuals, and then they have an opportunity to go and work in corporate America for a whole lot more money.
Yeah, you have to be able to pay your bills.
Absolutely. Everyone does.
Yeah. So as you've been evolving in your administrative responsibilities, what's been happening in dairy science? How has that changed?
There's been some evolution, and certainly we see some changes. I think that, you know, it's very true around the upper Midwest, particularly where dairy industry has been, or, you know, dairy positions, dairy departments have been very large at our universities. And I think we're seeing some reduction in the numbers of faculty that we have that are focused on dairy. That's true in other species as well. But I think we're seeing, you know, certain universities probably continue to focus a little bit more heavily on dairy, and we don't have lots of dairy individuals at every single land-grant university around the country. And that's probably been one of the biggest changes. But just the focus of the work we're doing and what we're teaching students. And so, you know, the hands-on learning for students has evolved tremendously. You're involved, for example, with the Intercollegiate Dairy Challenge. Mm-hmm. And I was involved in that at Purdue and coached teams there. And that, I've had many faculty members from around the country tell me that that's probably been the biggest single change to dairy education that's happened probably in the last 40 years.
Yeah.
And I think it's really true. Just the ability for students to, you know, just kind of assimilate everything that they've learned, not only in classes at the universities, but throughout their lives, and to put that all together in making professional recommendations to farms has just been, it's been transformational.
It really has. Yeah. Yeah. I coach the team here at Iowa State, and I always think about that. Like, I was not as good as you guys are.
Right,
when, like my students, I was not as good as they are when I was doing it when I was in college. And we had, I don't remember what year it was, but I think it was a year or two after I graduated, they posted like the winning presentations for people to be able to watch. And mm-hmm. the students that we have today are not to downplay those presentations, but just looking at how deeply students can think about things, how much they can pull together.
Yeah.
It's been in the soft skills, right? It's always been, it's not just about the textbook, which is something, and I know there was some, like Liz Karcher at Purdue did some work on this. I think it was probably, maybe, it must have been after you left, but she pulled together some information about what employers are looking for from their, from animal and dairy science students. And it's the soft skills.
It's the soft skills. Well, and it, to some degree, it's always been that. I mean, mm-hmm. even since I was a student, employers were saying they wanted communication skills. They wanted written, writing skills. Those have been important, but I think it's really kind of that, that logic and being able to justify decisions that you've made and, have practical information along with just, what you may have learned in classes. I think that's so important. But yeah, I think the style of presentations you mentioned, one of the classes that I had or one of the groups, I played some of the presentations for them the first time we met, and they said, we'll never be able to do that. And well, by the end of the semester, sure, they were right there with some of those leaders. It's pretty amazing.
It's a lot of fun. I had the same experience when I was coaching judging too. You bring somebody in to look at somebody with a lot of experience and say, you're going to be able to give reasons like that into their host. Oh, I don't think so. But then to coach them through it, it's a lot of fun.
So I helped Bill Wunder with the dairy cattle judging teams when I was a grad student.
Oh, really?
I kind of hit the crossroads about the time I was finishing that up and decided that you can't do a little bit of dairy judging.
It's true.
You either have to be all in or not in. And I decided that I was not in, but definitely support the activities and, certainly. It's been fun to follow a lot of the success that we've had here at the University of Minnesota over the years.
Yeah, you guys have kind of a powerhouse up there.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't say that since I'm being recorded. So hopefully, hopefully our Iowa State coach isn't listening to me.
And that's true, but you can be a proud alumni.
Yeah, I am a proud alumni at the University of Minnesota. That's right. Yeah. I didn't want to just talk to you about administrative stuff though, because you've actually done a lot of interesting stuff. And I think one of the things that struck me in your bio is when you talk about some of the things that you're still interested in on the research side. So do you really have a lot of time as department head to still be doing research, or are you?
I do not. So I don't get a lot of time to do research, but I still get to do a little bit. And so I would say that I haven't taken the lead on any classes here. Some department heads do that. Mm. I've focused a little bit more on continuing to do some things with extension, and then applied research. I still love that. So I've had the opportunity to continue a few things. One of the things that we're looking at right now is we have some data from a northern United States Jersey herd, and we're looking at the continued concerns about just colostrum production. And actually, I won't quote numbers right now, but a fairly large percentage of those cows produce zero colostrum mm-hmm. At calving. And so we're seeing that, certainly in the northern climates, it appears that it's much worse during the short daylight hours, like November through January or February. I know that in speaking to one of the farms here, a Jersey herd here in Minnesota, that is, it was building a new facility, and they're planning to build a walk-in cooler to store colostrum so they can get through those winter months. And so it continues to be a problem, but what we're looking at is we're trying to look at it from a genetic standpoint and see, is the trait heritable? And our preliminary work says, the colostrum production truly is heritable. What's a little harder to get at, based on our records, is how much is the change from summer to winter truly affected, because cows only calf at one point during the year. And so you don't have records for both necessarily. And so that's a little bit, a little bit challenging, but that's what we're trying to work on and trying to solve. And, interestingly, volume of colostrum does not appear to be very closely related to the genetics for milk production. I mean, you kind of think that there'd be a pretty strong correlation, but there is not. The correlation was really close to zero for the two traits. So I don't think it's just a production response that we're seeing in some cows.
Have you been able to look at like other components in colostrum? So would fat in colostrum be related to milk fat, or have you been able to look at that?
I haven't really looked at that. So this is an operating 6,000 cow dairy that we collected the records at. And so we were just very pleased that the workers were willing to record the amount of colostrum in bottles of colostrum. We were just happy that they were willing to record that data. So it's a lot of work. And so, we don't have individual animal samples or anything like that. But we did compare it to, eventual fat and protein yields and things like that. Not picking up really much of anything there.
It feels like every year we start to have this conversation right about now. Well, I should let our listeners know. I don't know when this episode will be released, but we're recording it in early September. And it feels like right around this fall is when we start talking about colostrum and managing colostrum volume. And every year we just don't have a good answer for what causes it or how to manage it. So,
well, and most likely the reason we don't have that answer is because it's very multifaceted, right? So it's affected. I think there's a genetic component to it, but there's also a seasonality effect. We know that that affects production in dairy cows. So why wouldn't it affect colostrum? I'm quite sure there's probably a breed effect. I'm quite sure that there are nutritional effects, things like niacin, vitamin E, that can affect the quality and the amount of colostrum that's produced. So there's lots of things going on. In Hort's Dairyman, probably about a year and a half ago, there was one of the responses in the question and answer session said probably the hair growth is playing a role, because the winter cows have to devote more protein to hair coat development, and could that be impacting colostrum or the colostrum quality, which is also largely a protein driven event? So who knows? I think it's just multifaceted, and there's just a lot going on,
and it's hard to measure and hard to quantify.
It's hard to measure, it's hard to quantify, at least in the numbers that we need to make the observational studies. Hopefully we'll be able to do some comparisons based on the sire evaluations that we'll have from this, and be able to look at some of the genomic components and see if there are any specific genes that may be impacting this. There's been some preliminary work out of Washington State University. It says there may very well be some candidate genes.
Well, cool. We'll have to have you back in a couple of years and see.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. The other thing I guess I continue to work on over my career at various stages, I've had opportunities to work on factors to standardize milk production records.
Mm-hmm.
So many years ago, I did the AM/PM adjustment, or the AMPM adjustment factors, but also the age season factors that are used to adjust for age, season, number of days open the cow was in the previous lactation. And so, but I think back to that, and that was in the early 1990s. And the reason I was kind of tasked with updating those records is that the previous time it had been done was by Ben McDaniel in 1968. And just recently, I've been able to connect with some of my colleagues at the Council for Dairy Cattle Breeding that are redoing those adjustment factors again. So every 24 years, whether it's needed or not, right?
Yeah.
And so I still get to dabble a little bit in some of the work related to the adjustment factors adjusting individual cow records so that they can be standardized for fair comparisons and genetic evaluations.
Very cool.
Better feed means better outcomes. This is why Lalamond Animal Nutrition, a global leader in microbial solutions, developed the clean feed approach. Lalamond protects your silage with research-proven forage inoculants, offering expert advice and services to maximize your investment and profitability. Their cutting-edge microbial solutions help boost feed efficiency and production, ensuring you are supported from field to feed out. Learn more at cleanfeedapproach.com.
So what do you think has been the biggest shift in the years that you've been doing genetic work? What has been the biggest change in the industry now versus when you got started?
So, you know, there's been lots of discoveries, but without a doubt, I think computing capacity, as we think about genetics and genetic improvement in dairy cattle, it's computing capacity that has really changed over the years. I mean, I think back to, you know, when I was in graduate school back in the mid-1980s, right? So there was this thing that came out called the animal model. So before that, all of the comparisons were only done on by, you know, sort of averaging out all of the production records of daughters of bulls, and the genetic evaluations were only calculated on those bulls because that's all that the computers could handle. And then we made that leap to an animal model where you also use the relationships among cows and the production records of the cows. And that was a huge step. And then about 2010, we had genomics came along. And so now, instead of having, you know, whatever you've got, there's something like 100 million cows in the database, but those cows each have like their genomics tests are like 50,000 individual data points up to, you know, perhaps 300,000 SNPs or individual data points. So just the ability to handle that kind of data is absolutely mind-boggling to me. And I think that's clearly the biggest change that that we've seen.
Yeah.
So then if you look at genomics and just how much it has speeded up our ability to select, particularly on the male side of the equation, and just the rate of genetic progress, that's been incredible. Yang Da, one of my faculty members here, is collaborating with the Council on Dairy Cattle Breeding, and they're developing evaluations to consider not only the additive genetics, which is entirely what we've used up to this point is really additive genetics, but they're also considering now the dominance effects. So how do changes at alleles really relate to each other and impact milk production? And also epistasis, which is, you know, how do alleles at different locations interact with each other? And we have the models have been constructed to be able to do that and be able to, you know, learn even more about how genetics works in dairy cattle. I think we're still another step away from the computing capacity being able to handle all of that data that we've got and those relationships. You know, it's interesting. I met with him once last year, and he said he had a postdoc that was working on a project. And I think it was in February when I talked to him, he said it had been running on the supercomputers since September. So, you know, we're talking about millions of hours of shared computer time to run some of these projects. It's amazing.
That's crazy. Well, and it's fascinating to me to hear you talk, because when did Gregor Mendel do his peace studies, right? And we thought we could
long ago. Some... It's like around 1870. I don't remember the exact year, but
still, we're looking at a couple hundred years plus, right? And it feels like we're still, like, when I talk to geneticists about what you're working on, you don't have it as figured out as I thought you did when I took the 300 level genetics course in undergrad. We still have a lot to learn.
But, you know, much of what's being done now is just extending the theory that was developed before we had all of these interesting tools, because people knew that there were these genes, and they knew that there were alleles that, you know, that were different and base pairs that made up the genes. So we started doodling around and figuring out how that could be harnessed if we ever figured out a way to determine what those actual genetic differences are. And now we're getting to that point.
It's pretty exciting.
Just, I think the thing, you know, another huge change is, you know, we had laboratories that were trying to create these genetic sequences, right? And so what the Human Genome Project, to do a single human genome, was intended to be about a 15-year project involving multiple institutions and laboratories. And a couple of weeks ago, one of my faculty members was working with someone in med school. And for a demonstration, they did the genetic sequence of a corn dog at the Minnesota State Fair in a little device that's about the size of a cigar box.
Oh, wow.
The good news is they did found that the all beef hot dogs were, in fact, all beef. And they found corn in the cornmeal used for the corn dog. And I think they may have found some wood, probably from the stick. But other than that, it was pretty pure.
I would expect nothing less than authenticity from the Minnesota State Fair. So.
Exactly. So the point wasn't in really doing the sequence. The point was in just demonstrating how quickly this can now be done.
That's amazing.
And so I think going to the future, we're probably going to see, you know, times when we have whole whole genetic sequences, I was going to say genome sequences, but genetic sequences of cattle that we can, you know, sort of mix and match to create, you know, whatever combination of traits we want.
That's pretty cool. It'd
be really exciting. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Our Yeast 40 ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Feed solutions that surpass expectations. Learn more about the benefits of working with Schooler. Visit schooler.com/feed. That's schooler.com/feed. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Your partner for extra animal performance, Bergen Schmidt Animal Nutrition.
Modern solutions for modern cows with AHV. Contact us to beat biofilm-related issues in your herd.
Adiseo, a global leader in nutritional solutions and the provider of Smartamine M, the best in-class rumen-protected methionine product for dairy producers who want to optimize milk production, capture more value from their components, and maintain the lifetime performance of their herds. For more product information and to calculate your return on investment when you balance your feed with amino acids, go to milkpay.com.
Well, we're at about that time when I'm supposed to wrap us up. It always feels like too short, but we're at that time. So we have three questions that we ask all of our guests. But before I ask you those questions, if people want to learn more about programs from your department or things that you're working on, is there any place that they should go to check out more of what you do?
Yeah, I would just send them to our animal sciences website. So just Google Animal Sciences at University of Minnesota, and it will take you to our research page. It will take you to our extension page, and you can get connected there.
Okay, so the first question that we ask all of our guests is, what is your favorite dairy-related book or resource?
Is it okay for me to have a couple?
Yes, I won't kick you off.
Well, it's really going to be three,
okay.
But I like the Journal of Dairy Science and the companion Journal of Dairy Science Communications. I think all of those are good. They have they're excellent in terms of separating out the audiences, and the more applied work goes into communications, and the more technical work probably is still in science. And then I have to say that I'm still a fan of Ward's Dairyman. I keep connected with it and still try to read it probably as much as anything else.
Yeah. JDS Communications, we've had a couple guests say that. And yes, as a fantastic, obviously Journal of Dairy Science, still love Journal of Dairy Science. But JDS Communications is really fun. And you get the graphical abstracts are really cool. You get some pretty hot topic stuff. I really enjoy it a lot. It's one I pay attention to as well.
Yep.
So then our second question, we asked about dairy related books and resources. What is your favorite non-dairy related book or resource?
Wow. That's more of a challenge. You know, I think it's interesting. People aren't going to necessarily relate to this as well, but, one of my favorite resources is Chronicle of Higher Education.
Oh, yeah.
But that's because I'm department head and things like that. There isn't one particular resource, but I'm kind of a geek for reading about crime mystery that particularly authors like John Sanford that are, everything is sort of located here in Minnesota. I kind of enjoy looking at those, reading those kinds of books and mysteries, because I find them very relatable.
Yeah,
not the murder part, but
the crime. Yeah, we can cut that part if you want. All right, and then our last question is: what sets successful dairy professionals apart from those that are not successful?
Yeah, I think the key thing is just being willing to take risks and embrace change, because this industry is full of changes. I think the old rule of thumb that we used to use was that unless a farm is doubling in size every 10 years, they're really standing still. Because it takes about 8 years to pay for the difference in salary that one needs based on inflation, and another 2 years to pay for the extra taxes that are involved with earning more income. And so, it just shows how far back farms, and it's not different for people involved in the industry, but it just shows how far back and how quickly one can fall behind if you're not innovating. And that cow numbers is a poor way of measuring that, of course. There's lots of ways to become more efficient and expand opportunities without only increasing milk sales.
All right, very good. Well, Mike, it was a great opportunity to chat with you today. Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Dairy Podcast Show.
It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.